Hello and welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Sleep Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. David Hanscom, whose orthopedic spine surgery practice focused on patients with failed back surgeries. He quit his practice in Seattle, Washington, to present his insights into solving chronic pain, which evolved from his own battle with it. His book, Back in Control, is associated with an action plan, which guides patients in solving mental and physical pain. Dr. David Hanscom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. I always enjoy being on your show.
So I want to talk to you about chronic pain. I know that the breadth of your experience and research goes beyond pain, but that sleep and pain are so intricately combined. So I definitely want to talk to you about what the basis of chronic disease is and how that impacts people's ability to rest and sleep.
Well, as we talked about before, the program is that the concepts about chronic disease are go really deep, but in a way they're simple is that basic science research in a bunch of different fields, cell biology, immunology, metabolism, etc., all point to the same thing, that there's a common link for every chronic disease. So it's basically a sustained elevation to inflammatory markers and sustained exposure to increased metabolism, which is fuel consumption. So when your body's in fight or flight for a prolonged period of time, it's like driving your car down the freeway in second gear. It's going to break down. And so, for instance, we know one of the biggest factors in creating chronic disease is chronic stress, not acute stress, but chronic stress, this unrelenting day after day where your body can't regenerate. So it turned out, in retrospect, that I'm a surgeon. I thought everything was structural. Turns out the vast majority of symptoms, probably 90% plus, are based on the body's physiology. When I say physiology, it's how the body functions. Your temperature, blood pressure, heart rate, kidney balance, all sorts of things are the physiology or how your body functions. So it turns out that when you're in fight or flight, humans have a term for that physiological state called anxiety. So it turns out anxiety is physiological, not psychological. It's the result of stress, not the cause. It's a million times stronger than your conscious brain, and you can't control it. So anxiety and anger are inflammatory states. They are not subject to rational control. They are a million times stronger than your conscious brain. So there are a bunch of ways of lowering your inflammatory markers, with sleep probably being number one. And why is that? So let me just talk about the evidence about why sleep is such a critical aspect. So, for instance, there's a study out of Israel done about 6 years ago that showed that lack of sleep actually caused chronic back pain. So I was not aware of that in my clinical practice. And so I go, huh. But what was really interesting, I always thought that chronic pain caused lack of sleep. And of course, there's some data on that also. But in this very well-done study, they did not find that to be true. They found out that lack of sleep did not cause, they found that lack of sleep caused a chronic pain. The chronic pain was not what caused lack of sleep. So what causes lack of sleep is a fired up nervous system, fired up metabolism. Your whole body's on fire. So when your body's activated, how can you sleep? Right? So the lack of sleep is an activated total body response to stress. And when you can't turn it off at night, your body stays fired up, you stay on high alert, and you can't sleep. So then they've done studies showing that lack of sleep, one night of bad sleep, actually increases your pain 50% the next day. Just one night of sleep. Then they found out that lack of sleep is a higher predictor of disability than the pain. So as a surgeon, I'm going, well, the pain's bad, disables you, can't work. There's actually a high correlation with lack of sleep than there actually is with the pain. So with lack of sleep, a bunch of things happen. So at nighttime, your body needs what's called the lymphatic system. So it's like a lymphatic system with a G. And what the lymph system does, it's like your how do I say it? It's like a waste bag. I won't say garbage can because it's not garbage, but your waste products are cleaned out through the lymph system, which is a separate system different than your bloodstream. So your bloodstream is exchanging oxygen, transporting inflammatory cells, but it's the lymph system that cleans house. So just a few years ago, they discovered an equivalent in the brain called the glymphatic system that happens mostly at night. So why that's so critical is that for human beings, about 20 to 25% of our entire metabolic energy is spent running our brains, whereas most mammals is between 4 to 8%. So, for instance, in a chess match, they've seen chess players lose 15 pounds during a chess match. They think that 50% of the body's metabolic energy is actually in the brain during a chess match. So there's a tremendous energy requirements of the brain in general. And then sleep is critical actually to clean out the waste products. So half your brain is neurons and half your brain is what's called glial cells. They're little cells that provide structure, framework. They also is where the lymphatic system goes to work. They also have inflammatory receptors in the lymph in this glial cell system. So the brain is actually an extension of the immune system.
Which is, relatively new information, right? I mean, as far as like, we used to think that at least medical used to think that the brain was kind of disconnected from the body and didn't have its own immune system. And now we know a lot different, right?
Well, remember the brain evolved late. So it is completely entwined with every cell of your body. And see, as humans and mammals specialized and developed different organ systems, then they had to communicate over long distances, hence neurons. Then as humans develop consciousness, why they have what's called the neocortex, which other mammals don't have. But if you look at a chimpanzee or a orangutan or an ape or gorilla, they're actually 99.9% the same genetic material of humans. And some of them have a partial neocortex and they can actually think pretty clearly. What they don't have is language. So it gives humans the differentiation and gives us a competitive advantage, by the way, is language. So we can cooperate, we can survive better. And so humans for millions of years, and again, my source is the book Sapiens. I'm not an expert on anthropology, but his point being that humans consumed about 20 to 25% of the metabolic energy just to run the brain, whereas other animals had only 4 to 8%. So from a food physical survival standpoint, we're at the bottom of the food chain for millions of years. So when we learned to cooperate about 100,000 years ago with language, why we started actually, unfortunately, destroy a lot of other species and went to the top of the food chain. So anyway, the neocortex is unusual. Humans are the only species that have it. It creates a tremendous amount of energy. And it's really critical to have sleep in order to maintain your brain's functions.
All right. Gosh, you said a lot. I'm taking a deep breath on behalf of everybody that's watching. Like, all right.
Okay, I'm trying to keep it simple. I'm not doing very well.
No, and it's not that you need to keep it simple because this is all fascinating and I'm keeping up. I just want to, circle back to a couple of things that you said because it's fascinating. And so, obviously we have, let's go back to kind of inflammation, right? So if you've got, I think you said anxiety is more of a response to stress and is the symptom of stress. We've right. got kind of all of these thought patterns that are activated and get us in an aroused state. And right. who's going to be able to rest when you're aroused, right?
Right.
So
right.
how do we go, where do we go from there? We have that piece of knowledge. Now, how do we transition arousal and agitation and immune response from all of that stress and arousal and agitation? How do we then, since we're not in physical control of it, as you said, how do we then transition that into a more restful state?
Was a friend of mine, Bruce Lipton, who wrote a book called The Biology of Belief, and his point is that we have no control. We have no control over our survival responses. So again, this activated threat response and hyperactivated threat response that we call anger and anxiety are the same thing, we have no control over. So to try to change those or control those, you must be talking to the hard drive of your computer. So it's very bidirectional. So for instance, an activated nervous system causes lack of sleep, which is inflammatory. Then your lack of sleep is inflammatory, which causes an activated nervous system. So everything we talk about, every part of the healing journey is bidirectional. So what I want to talk about is how do you heal? So let's talk about, let me just jump back just a little bit in the whole story about how the whole doc journey evolved. So it's in my process, it started with sleep. So I was in Sun Valley, Idaho. I went from being a major tertiary spine surgeon to being in a small private practice in a small town. So I basically became not only a spine surgeon, but also became a primary care physician as a spine physician. But also had done 2 years of internal medicine. So I knew a lot about primary care, but I took a surgeon's approach to it. That was the difference. So I had read a book that a person gave me in Sun Valley called The Promise of Sleep, written by Dr. William DeBent, who started the whole process in the 60s, his point being that only 5% of physicians actually address sleep issues. Now, I think the number is better now, but probably not a lot better. So we have all these symptoms created by lack of sleep, including chronic pain. And I would ask the audience, how many of your physicians have actually asked you, how are you sleeping? Simple question. It is always solvable, believe it or not. It's a different topic we'll talk about in a second. So I said, okay, I can do that. So I took a certain approach to sleep. I did sleep hygiene. I had to read some books to calm down, mindfulness, relaxation. And then the thing that really started the process was this expressive writing. You should be write down your thoughts, and you can't control your thoughts, but you can separate from them. So it turns out, I didn't know this at the time, that expressive writing actually helps you induce sleep. It doesn't keep you asleep. The research shows it helps you get to sleep. It doesn't necessarily keep you asleep, but it is a tool. So between what we call sleep hygiene, getting people to relax, not drink caffeine late in the day, not overexercising, et cetera, there's a bunch of sleep hygiene rules that we started putting into place. And then if you weren't sleeping within 2 to 4 weeks, I would put them on drugs. So my goal is within 6 or 8 weeks, everybody was sleeping. Now what happened, and again, I was not expecting this. I was just trying to manage their pain, manage who they were. About 20% of people just went to pain-free, just with the sleep. I'm going, huh. So that caught my attention. So actually, it turned out that was the beginning of the entire, what we call the DOC journey, the direct your own care journey. So it turns out that there's a bunch of tools you can use to get sleep, but unless you can actually consistently get an adequate night's sleep, you're not going to heal. You can't do it. So then I don't want to rant too much here, but I'll just vent for a second. I mean, we're doing major, huge, damaging, risky spine surgeries on people. They're getting bigger and bigger. We're seeing a higher and higher failure rate. And I still don't know of any surgeons, or hardly any surgeons, are saying, are you sleeping? So why would I do a 10-hour operation on you when the first thing I need to do is just get you to sleep? So even if you do the surgery, we know that the surgical outcomes are optimized dramatically with adequate sleep. So when you go back in my evolution of the process of the doc journey, sleep is number one. It's still number one. Now, when I say number one, expressive writing is the number one tool. Active meditation is a very high level tool. Another tool is never discuss your pain, no complaining, no talking about your health care. So what you're doing, you're calming the input down. So between not discussing your pain, not discussing health care, expressive writing, relaxation, plus sleep hygiene, that's the start to the doc journey. So what I'd like to propose is the model that we now call dynamic healing. So every living creature processes their environment and stays alive. I'm sorry, every creature stays alive by interpreting their environment and sending out signals to the bodies to act accordingly. So if you see a dog rushing at you, you're going to run away. Your body says run, so you run. But it also happens chemically. If you have a bacteria invading your body fires up and fights it off. So the body is always looking for danger, always putting up defenses. So we call it the input, or your stresses. Then you have your actual nervous system, the brain, that interprets the signals. Then it sends out signals to your body that's either fight or flight or safety. We call that the physiology. So the essence of chronic disease in every realm is sustained exposure to fight or flight physiology. And again, we call that anxiety, but it's not anxiety. It's not the cause of the threat, it's the result. So there's ways of directly dropping your physiology from fight or flight into safety. So we know, and what you're trying to do is stimulate what's called the vagus nerve. It's a parasympathetic nervous system. It's highly anti-inflammatory. So things like slow breathing, breath work, humming, for instance, stimulates the 7th cranial nerve, which stimulates the 10th nerve. Certain pitches of music stimulate your 8th cranial nerve, or your auditory nerve, which calms things down. Even a washcloth on your forehead or rubbing your forehead stimulates the 5th cranial nerve, which stimulates the vagus nerve. So those are anti-inflammatory interventions that just directly drop it down right now. So that's the output. Then with the nervous system, you have exercise. So you want to increase the resiliency of the nervous system. So that's diet, exercise, and sleep. So again, sleep by itself doesn't usually solve the problem, but it's one of those critical steps. So then the final thing is, if you're going to do trauma therapy, if you need trauma therapy, which a lot of people do, again, you're increasing the resiliency of the nervous system. So again, you have the output in the nervous system, then the input is really critical. So if you're talking about your pain, complaining, gossiping, giving advice, being critical, your body's fired up. So that's the cardinal rule, no complaining. Any realm, remember this is mental and physical pain, so no complaining. So expressive writing separates you from your thoughts, again, changes the input. Cognitive behavioral therapy allows you to recognize your thinking patterns and change those, so again, you're changing the input. But the biggest one is anger, forgiveness. So the way human brain works is that 90% of people in chronic pain are still angry at the person or situation that caused the problem in the first place. But guess who they are the most angry at?
I would guess themselves.
Yeah. Themselves. So it doesn't help you. If you're angry at yourself, you're in fight or flight all the time. So it always turns out that some level of forgiveness, I now call it anger processing. I don't like the word forgiveness anymore. It's too big a word. But some form of anger processing allows you to dramatically drop down everything. So again, lack of sleep calms things down, allows you to lower the inflammation so you're less reactive, allows you to sleep. Then the other thing is, as far as the input, again, allows things to calm down. So it's very back and forth all the time. So again, dynamic healing. When your stresses, what we call allostatic load, exceed your coping capacity, you go into fight or flight. Now, humans have another problem that we may talk about in another day, is that thoughts have been documented to be as inflammatory. I'm sorry, unpleasant thoughts are as much of a threat as a physical threat. They share the same circuits in the brain. You have the same physiological response, and we cannot escape our thoughts. And it turns out that suppressed thoughts are actually more of a threat than expressed thoughts. So suppressing thoughts actually causes shrinkage of your brain. It shrinks the memory center of your brain called the hippocampus. So when you express a thought or repress a thought, it's a problem. So for instance, what the expressive writing seems to do is simply separates you from your thoughts. Just an exercise that why it is the one necessary starting point in the DOC journey or a similar healing journey. So again, human consciousness, okay, so let me just separate this out just for a second so we can think about this more clearly. So unpleasant thoughts are your psyche. So they are sensory input that's unpleasant. Your emotions is what you feel. Your emotions is what you feel with your physiology. So your unpleasant thoughts are the input. Your unpleasant emotions are the output. You can't control your thoughts, but you can separate from them. You can't control your anxiety and reaction, but you can change the physiology. In other words, there's ways of calming things down. You change the input. You can directly... So once you can't control your physiology, I mean, you can by stimulating the vagus nerve, but you can't do it with mind.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's things that you can interrupt.
You can do, maybe. Right. Right, but see, what doesn't work is mind over matter, because it's a million to one ratio, so mind over matter doesn't work. Positive thinking doesn't work. It's a way of suppressing. So anyway, I don't know how much detail you want to go into the whole project, but the idea is that sleep is in the middle, right? There increases the resiliency of the nervous system. So in the dynamic healing model, you're working on the resiliency of the nervous system, and that's where sleep comes into play. And it's a big one. Sleep is a huge factor in solving, again, not just chronic pain. You remember, mental pain is a bigger problem than physical pain. Every chronic disease is affected by lack of sleep, every one of them.
And they're all exacerbated, right?
Right.
I mean, in severity. And I think a lot of people think of it in the reverse order. So I really appreciate that you shared the data with us that it's actually the other way around. I think most people don't notice they're not sleeping well until all of these other things are getting out of control. But it's in fact the sleep lack and building of sleep loss that has brought it to their attention and made it severe enough, whether it's mental illness or physical, you know, limitations or pain, things like that. It always ends up coming to a head with a lack of sleep. But in fact, right, the sleep has been, because there's different types of sleep and different quality of sleep and things like that. And so even if you're sleeping, you know, 6 hours a night, if you're only getting light sleep and you're not getting all the stages of your sleep, then your quality of sleep is super low. You know, people you sleep aids, or they you know, substitute alcohol or things like that in order to help them sleep. And they think, you know, I went to bed at 10 p.m. and I woke up at 6. I don't know why I'm still tired. I don't know why I'm so fatigued. I don't know why I don't feel rested. Right. And all of these things play into the quality of your sleep and how well you're actually sleeping. And therefore, you know, the glymphatic system, how well you're able to get all of the waste products out of your brain from processing. Same with your body. All those systems that are working and harmoniously humming along without your direct control are impacted, kind of at, like dominoes, right?
Right. Well, if you think about it, as I'm listening to you speak, which I think you hit it right on the head, is that sleep is sort of a symptom, just one of the symptoms of a fired up nervous system, right? So again, this that bidirectional thing where sleep is a symptom of a fired up nervous system, but yet lack of sleep also fires up the nervous system. And that's why it's never a single approach that solves chronic pain, mental and physical. It's always bidirectional. So yeah, if you can, again, when I was in primary care, I was unapologetic. You just had to get sleep. So probably 70% of the time I used medications for 6 to 12 weeks to get it done. And again, I took a surgeon's approach to primary care and said, look, instead of seeing back in a month, I'm gonna see you back in 5 days or make a phone call. So I see people every week until they were sleeping. I can't even tell you how critical that was. And then it's pretty fruitless to try to pursue other treatments if you're not sleeping.
Well, and that accountability, I bet, is really important too, right? Like, it's hard to change. It's hard to make behavior right. changes and adaptations, even when you know, I mean, that's the human condition, right? Like yep. most of us know the right thing to do. We just struggle to do it, right? Like I'm currently battling against getting my phone out of my bedroom at night and lowering my caffeine intake in the morning. And these are like simple things. But it's just hard for human beings to adapt and change, even when they know what they're supposed to do.
So this is an entire podcast on
we could do a whole other talk on that, right?
Well, I mean, I just wrote a blog today on diet because we know how we should eat, but why don't we always eat healthily, right? So here's the problem. So, okay, I have a belief system about my diet. Mine's different than yours. And I follow it 80% of the time. Then the 20% of the time that I don't follow the diet, I am critical, self-critical. So being self-critical is inflammatory. Now, what happens when your body's inflamed, anxiety or anger, the blood supply of your brain shifts from the neocortex or the thinking centers into the survival brain. So that's why we behave in ways that are less than ideal, because we actually cannot think clearly. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I want you to say it again, though. Yeah.
So when you are anxious or frustrated, it means you've been triggered. So something in the present reminded you of something in the past that was dangerous or perceived as dangerous. So you go into fight or flight, your blood supply shifts from your thinking centers to the survival centers, and you physiologically cannot think clearly. You cannot, it's impossible. So there's a whole way of dealing with that, and it's again the 1,000,000 to 1 ratio, mind over matter does not work. So when you're in that reactive state, you just have to intellectually say, okay, I'm not in the present moment. So I have a person I'll have you talk to for another podcast. She's just brilliant on this. Also a friend of mine in Australia is that if you're smoking and you want to quit smoking, you know you shouldn't smoke. Why do you keep doing it? So you might quit for a week or a month. Some people do quit, of course, but it's harder to quit smoking, by the way, than it is to give up heroin. It's that an addicting a drug. So what happens, you go off for 3 months, 6 months, maybe even a year, then you fall off the wagon, and of course you're self-critical. Or you're always... So what happens, we call it cognitive fatigue. You have a desire to smoke, we have a desire to eat badly, or we have a desire to do this, this, and this. But again, such a massive force about anxiety and anger driving it that you get worn out. So the key issue is, this is an overstated phrase, but it's actually fairly serious. You have to learn to love yourself no matter what. Okay, so I ate well 5 days of the week. I ate terribly for 2 days. That's fine. I mean, you just you can't stop judging yourself, but as you become aware of judging yourself, it starts to dissolve it. So whether you follow your own internal rules or don't follow your own internal rules, it's okay either way.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, yeah. It's like you just stop assigning meaning to information. Right.
Well, the problem is we keep living our lives by our self-critical voice. The self critical voice is incredibly inflammatory. And of course, incredible anxiety. And so it's a whole process. Again, you can't just stop it either. And that's where, again, I have a process called the DLC journey, called Direct Your Own Care Journey. So there's seven legs. And the first leg just gets you some tools to start calming down. Then the second leg helps you understand why you're doing what you're doing. The third leg is anxiety, then awareness. Then the fifth leg is anger. And that's where the rubber really hits the road, but you can't get to solving anger from just thinking about it. It's a whole skill set. So if you decide to do the process, I recommend strongly that you just do maybe 10 or 15 minutes a day. That's it. Because this repetition allows you to program your brain for things to become automatic. So again, sleep's right in section one. You have to deal with it. And you may not be successful for 3 to 6 months. I mean, you may not be sleeping as well as you would like, but you can get some initial benefits pretty well, because you have to start healing in other domains for actually sleep to become an issue. In other words, lack of sleep is from a fired up fight or flight response. So again, there's the input nervous system and the output. All things actually contribute to a good night's sleep. So that's where it's a very dynamic process. It's been extremely consistent. The key is learning the tools and just making them automatic with repetition. And it's been exciting to watch people's pain honestly disappear. Now, I say that tongue in cheek, because if you quit practicing the tools, the pain does come back. I mean, they are permanent circuits. So again, it's a day-to-day process. You get very good at processing the stress, absorbing it, moving forward. And so again, it's just been really a rewarding process to watch people heal. And as you know, I quit my practice to do this. I was so tired of watching people being badly damaged by ineffective spine surgery and expensive, risky, totally just would destroy people's lives. Then I'm watching hundreds of patients get better with essentially no resources, minimal risk, minimal resources. And they got so much better so quickly. I said, you know, I just can't do this anymore. So I quit my practice about 3 years ago to pursue what I could do, you know, trying to change things. And so, yeah, it's been an incredibly rewarding phase of my career.
It sounds like it. And so, I think, yeah. You know, what you just said, I think really highlights, you know, both doctors and patients, I think, if I could speak for them, they want to help people, right? They want to give people a solution. Right. And often, you know, the process that you're talking about, like, as you said, is going to take weeks to months, right? And to make small incremental changes over a long time can result in a need for no, you know, major interventions, as long as you kind of keep up those practices. But, you know, most people, they want to help people. They want to give them a pill, or they want to give them a procedure that's going to, you know, automatically eliminate the problem.
Right.
When in most cases, that's not necessary, and as you were speaking, can cause more damage than it does heal. And so that's, I think, you know, the human condition, where it's such a challenge to get people to sign on to, like, something that it might take a while. I'm going to get you to sleep, and I'm going to get you to sleep well, but it's going to take a while, and you're going to have to do it every day. And they're like, but will it take longer than it will to take a pill?
Well, but also in medicine, we're treating just the symptoms. Remember, you have your stresses and your nervous system. So if you come into me with a stomach ache, I can give you medication. I'm treating just the symptoms. But if I send you home to an abusive relationship, you have an abusive relationship, your coping skills are marginal, that's the root problem. We're not addressing the root cause. It takes a little bit of time, not a lot of time to do it. So that's the whole dynamic healing process, is addressing that root cause of the mismatch between your circumstances and your coping skills.
Yeah.
And so that's what's been so effective about it. People heal themselves. My excitement not only is seeing people heal that thought they had no hope, but once you actually change the way you process your life, it keeps growing in the direction you want it to go. Yeah. So people don't, I mean, you always relapse up and down in a given day or given week, but very, very few people go right back into the hole they started in. It's been very rewarding that way.
That is rewarding. All right. So before I let you go, I want, you know, we talked about a lot of things today, but I mean, the thing that stands out for me and is part of the DOC journey that you talked about, if I heard you correctly, that people could start today, is that kind of expressive journaling piece, right?
Right.
And so could you describe that to us and how somebody could get started with that today?
So I did put together an 8-page PDF that describes it in detail what to do. But the simplest form of it, and again, there's a bunch of different forms of it. There's over 1,200 research papers that documents that it works. But you simply write down your thoughts and tear them up. And the more clear, the more that the writing reflects your emotions and feelings, the more effective it is, but it doesn't have to be that way. Most of the research has been done on negative writing, where you simply write down negative thoughts. That's a little risky. I don't encourage that. So just any writing that you want to put down on paper is fine. And it's just an exercise. So it can be 30 seconds, could be an hour. It doesn't really matter. You just write down your thoughts and you tear them up. Now, what happens, I think, again, this is not a neuroscience explanation, but your thoughts are here and you're here. There's now a space of, you're now separated from your thoughts by vision and feel. And so that's part of the unconscious brain. So you tear them up for two reasons. One is to write with freedoms, because the crazier the thought you get on paper, the more powerful it is. Secondly, I think it's more important is that when you write, all these issues start coming up, right? They're not issues. They're just thoughts. So if you, and some people say it's very interesting because a lot of people just don't want to tear up their thoughts. And you're not trying to get rid of them because there's trillions of thoughts. You're just separating, just an exercise. But people get attached to their thoughts, right? They're just thoughts. So if you want to spend time analyzing these thoughts, where's your attention? It's on the thoughts. So I do want to, I have lots of metaphors. I just going to sneak one more in.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, there's two parts to healing, and they're separate skill sets, but they're linked. Okay. But you can't use one to deal with the other. So anxiety and anger, or activated threat physiology, are these massive, powerful survival responses that are gifts. Anxiety and anger are gifts. They keep us alive. We would not be alive without anxiety and anger. So they're necessary. They're powerful. You can't control them. And you can learn how to process them. And that's a learned skill set. So the way you lower anxiety, you simply lower your threat physiology. So then the real healing occurs. I call it moving into joy. Good food, good wine, good friends, play, spending time with your kids and family, just relaxing. But if you're using things and activities in life to distract you from the anxiety and anger, it's a million to one mismatch. So once you learn, again, this happens every day, multiple times a day, is never one and done. So you learn how to process anxiety and anger as it comes on board, which happens every day, become very skilled at it, and you also become skilled about nurturing joy. So there's separate energies, but you can't use the joy to counteract this massive survival circuits. So that's really the key to the whole process. And that's why the doctrine is a little different, in that we understand the physiology of it. We're allowing you to separate. And then as you separate, then you can move forward. And it's very exciting to see how people move forward, including me, by the way. I mean, I'm living a life that I never thought was possible. But I'm watching it happen over and over and over again. So it's very consistent. If you engage, you can't read a book. Get a practice.
Yeah. And I love what you said about anxiety and anger. I mean, they are key to survival. And so just acknowledging that. And in the last couple of years, I've actually developed a gratitude practice toward both right. those emotions of like, thank you. Like, I get right. it. You're trying to protect me. You're trying to keep right. me safe. Like, right. thank you. I'm good. I got it. I hear you. Message received.
Right.
I am not being eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, right?
Yep.
But to just acknowledge, like, those are normal human emotions that you are meant to have in order to have protection, and that the kind of changing that association and the meaning that you assign to it, kind of step one.
But also reminds me that people in the lay literature still talk about how anxiety is useful. To be successful. So it's necessary to stay alive and take care of yourself. It's necessary to read the cues of danger around you. But see, what happened to me got me in trouble. I used that adrenaline drive to be, quote, successful. But that's the problem, because you're always adrenalized. Going back to the analogy of driving your car down the freeway in second gear, you're in overdrive. That's what makes you sick. So have you read the articles I've read about, you know, how anxiety is necessary and it's okay to be anxious, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, I've definitely seen that, yeah.
Well, it's not only okay, you can't avoid it, except if you're using that energy to actually be successful, that's what wears you out. So paradoxically, as you don't wear yourself out trying to fight anxiety and anger, you have way more energy to actually do what you want to do. But yeah, that's that nervous drive that got me to be this major spine surgeon. That's what made me sick, really sick.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people have arrived that place eventually with anxiety where, you know, it feels for a while like a superpower.
Right.
Like I've got this store of energy and focus that other people don't have, but then there's a law of diminishing returns over time.
Yep. Very quickly.
Very quickly. Yeah. And then it is not the superpower that you thought it was.
Right.
Dr. David Hanscom, how can people find out more about you and the Doc Journey?
So there, I have a website called www.thedocjourney.com. Stands for Direct Your Own Care. So it's docjourney.com. And it's a monthly subscription. And again, I urge people maybe spend 10 or 15 minutes a day with it. We also have the Doc Journey app, which is based on our workshops, which is educational, engaging. My wife's a tap dancer who put that together. So it's very entertaining, has the cup song, juggling scarves, dancing kitties, all sorts of stuff. But it's not meant to be light, make light of your pain, because pain is horrible. But it allows your brain to shift into a sense of play, which is safety, which is a profound shift in your body's chemistry. So the app's been very popular, very successful also. And then I have a book called Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, which is sort of the foundational set of knowledge. And so, yeah, those are things that have been consistent. Part of the Doc Journey course, by the way, and the app is I do offer a separate coaching session twice a week that I run myself. It's a group of 25 to 35 people. And that's been really helpful for generalized support and education. So, yeah, I'm just doing what I can do to try to get people better. And I get emails every week of people going, geez. I mean, I'm just always, how do I say this? I've watched this happen hundreds and hundreds of times. And I just had a gentleman this week who's an attorney who's been working with me in the coaching group for about a year. And I sort of given up, very adamant that there's something wrong. The surgeon wanted to do surgery. And I, you know, I don't argue with people very much. I just let it run its course. But I did encourage him to stick with the course. And just last week, he said, look, neck pain's gone. My arm pain's gone. I'm sleeping and my anxiety's gone. He completely transformed. And I would not have given him a shot at it a year ago. So I'm always fascinated about how deeply the healing process can go. It's exciting.
That is exciting. I'm sure you're proud of that too.
Yeah. No, it's very rewarding.
Dr. David Hanscom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.